"Most Ovarian Cancer Isn't," starts the headline from the New York Times at the end of July. It's the Lee Rayburn Show, and today we're taking a look at why that could reduce cancer risks by nearly 80% for what is considered ovarian cancer, which may in fact be a misnomer. Do you have questions about ovarian cancers? You can join our conversation at any time this hour at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us an email to talk@WPR.org. Our guest is Dr. Summer Wallace. She is a gynecological oncologist at UW Health and an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Wallace, welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. It's an honor to be here.
Thank you for being here. And let's just start with this idea that ovarian cancer is kind of a misnomer. Why is that?
Yeah, our field has been developing and gathering more information over more than a decade now regarding where ovarian cancer actually starts. And over that time, we've realized that it most likely starts, or most episodes of ovarian cancer most likely start in the fallopian tube, actually, or in the end of the fallopian tube, which we call the fimbriated end, and metastasizes from there.
And why has, do we still call it ovarian cancer, or is ovarian cancer sort of a blanket term for any number of cancers that can develop in the reproductive system of women?
We do. We are altering that to a certain extent. For the most part, we're calling it ovarian cancer. By the time we see it, it involves the ovary, and that is the easiest place for us to kind of call. The fallopian tube itself, when we find it early, it's more discerning to say, oh, this started here and it spread. Unfortunately, many ovarian cancers are diagnosed at an advanced stage. And so by the time we see them and they involve the ovary, we call it ovarian cancer. Whether or not that's a misnomer is the debate currently. And it may be, for the most part, it's an academic question related to the pathology that does not impact the treatment per se. But we're learning so much.
Yeah, it's because this seems to have been within the last 25 years that this sort of research and understanding of female reproductive cancers has developed.
Yeah, you're right. In our field, over the last 10 to 15 years, we've taken this up as the norm and have identified that the fallopian tubes are an important structure in diagnosing and preventing ovarian cancer. So we've been kind of performing this opportunistic salpingectomy procedure in gynecologic cases during that time. The broader population is now getting to hear about our advancements and hopefully going to benefit from it.
You said the term, and I don't know that I'll be able to repeat it accurately, but the procedure is removing the fallopian tube, right?
Correct, yes. So opportunistic salpingectomy, or as you may see it in literature, OS, is removing the fallopian tubes in their entirety during a procedure that wasn't meant to remove the fallopian tubes. So we are being opportunistic in the sense that we're, while we're there, we're removing those tubes in an effort to prevent ovarian cancer in the future.
So this would happen in the process of another abdominal procedure. What types of abdominal procedures might include the removal of fallopian tubes?
Right. Yeah, for the last several years in gynecologic surgeries, for example, when a woman would go to get a hysterectomy, mm-hmm. That maybe her ovaries weren't required to be removed. For the last several years, we had just been removing the tubes and leaving the ovaries behind so that that woman would not go through menopause during that surgery. But we would still be deriving the benefit of removing the tubes and reducing ovarian cancer risk.
Dr. Summer, who's at risk for ovarian cancers? Do we have any sort of understanding of who may be more likely to develop these types of cancers?
Yeah, great question. There's a lot of risk factors related to age, menopausal status, reproductive history, And of course, genetic dispositions, predispositions are an important factor in ovarian cancer diagnosis.
The BRCA1 and BRCA2 gene, I know this from in my own family, seems to be a genetic marker that could portend the likelihood of cancers, if I understand that right, Dr. Wallace. And how, tell us a little bit about our understanding of genetics and the role of the potential for cancers and how recent this development is.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that your family's having to deal with those types of medical issues. So both BRCA1 and 2 can increase risks of ovarian cancer significantly, up to 60 and 30 or 40% respectively. And so I agree. So nothing to sneeze at. So we have recommendations nationally that are standardized in our guidelines for removal of the tubes and ovaries in a prophylactic or preventative manner. We call it a risk-reducing bilateral salpingo oophorectomy. And so we have specific ages for both of those particular genetic changes, usually by age 35 or 45, depending on which mutation you have, that we would recommend having the tubes and ovaries removed to prevent ovarian cancer.
What's the outcome of this procedure? What happens to the body after you remove fallopian tubes? Are there long-term effects? Are there hormonal changes?
Great question. The benefits, are obvious in the sense that we are effectively reducing that risk of ovarian cancer by up to 90-95%.
Oof.
And we also are, in some patients, reducing the risk of breast cancer, depending on their menopausal status. But as you're alluding to, the negatives are that we are also, in some women who are before menopause, inducing surgical menopause, which can be difficult for many reasons. The earlier we induce menopause in someone who isn't going through that transition naturally, the more impact can be seen. And so, for example, along with those side effects of menopause that can impact quality of life significantly, things like hot flashes, night sweats, difficulty sleeping, there can be other systemic or bodily impacts that can be present, like cardiac changes, skin changes, cognitive changes that can impact long-term health. So we try really to avoid really early menopause, but there's a balance here, right?
Right.
Because, we don't want ovarian cancer either. And so many times we try to discuss that timeline with patients and personalize it as much as we can.
Yeah. And so it's individualized to the patient, but in the ballpark, you mentioned 35 to 45. Was that a general age range of consideration?
Correct. Depending on, so BRCA1, we usually recommend removal earlier, and 2 can wait a little bit longer. But yes, that's the general age range of what we're looking at.
And how recent is this genetic connection been made to the likelihood of cancers?
We've known about this particular genetic mutation for years, decades even.
Huh.
But we're getting better at genetic testing. So we're discovering new mutations that have not quite as high of a risk of ovarian cancer as the BRCA mutations, but still, in the 10% range. And at that point, we still do discuss removing the tubes and ovaries. We have been looking closer at what it means to potentially remove the tubes on an interval basis, meaning, so for example, if a woman has BRCA1 and she's 35 or 32, and she wants to have her tubes and ovaries out, is there the possibility of removing just the tubes to gain benefit, delaying removing the ovaries in order to maintain that hormone and delay menopause? There's actually a study ongoing right now that we've had open here at UW Health to look just at that.
So it would be fallopian tubes in one procedure and then wait to remove the ovaries at another procedure. And what would be the benefit of that as you're studying at UW Health, Dr. Wallace?
Yeah, there's definitely pros and cons there, right? The pros being the potential of reducing ovarian cancer risk while maintaining the ovaries and delaying menopause.
Okay.
Of course, as you mentioned, it's requiring two procedures, which is different from what we have historically done, where we do this all with the same procedure. But that's, you know, part of doing research is to try to figure out, is the benefit greater than that the con there?
And it's a constant balance, and it's individualized to the patient. How invasive is this procedure, and what does recovery look like for the patient, Dr. Wallace?
Well, when we're doing this procedure on its own, standalone, it is usually a minimally invasive procedure. Most patients have this done in, you know, 30 minutes to an hour, depending on their specific history. Huh. Most patients go home the same day.
Whoa.
Yeah, it's really great. Made quite a bit of advancement with our ability for patients to be able to go home the same day with our surgeries, which is wonderful.
Dr. Summer Wallace, our guest, a gynecological oncologist at UW Health and an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, taking a look at a procedure removing the fallopian tubes, which could reduce ovarian cancer by as much as 80%. I believe you even suggested higher than that, Dr. Wallace, potentially.
Right. When we are removing the ovaries with the tubes is when that's higher. When we're removing the tubes on their own, we think that's in the 80% range.
Okay.
We've learned a lot. You know, we used to wonder, is this 50%? But as we've done more of these over the last several years, we think it is higher in that 80% range.
And you're invited to our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email to talk@wpr.org. When it comes to cancer in general, Dr. Wallace, I always think that early detection is best and early treatment is best. But why is screening for ovarian cancer such a struggle?
I couldn't agree more. And it has been one of the frustrations of our field. We've been trying for years to develop a screening test so that we can detect ovarian cancer earlier and, you know, save more lives. Unfortunately, it hasn't been borne out. We've tried various lab tests, imaging studies, combinations of these things, and we have not been able to find any test or combination of tests that has found ovarian cancer earlier and was able to impact long-term prognosis or outcomes. And so by the time we're seeing it, it is more advanced. And that is obviously harder to treat and harder to cure.
I find that strange because I do believe there's a blood test for prostate cancer that I've taken. And so that would be an early detection opportunity, but that does not exist for ovarian cancer. Does the understanding that many of these cancers start in the fallopian tube perhaps change the science behind searching for early screening detection tools?
You know, it could, in the sense of fallopian tube cancer becoming ovarian cancer, the imprint or the precursor lesion for that is actually similar. And so us being able to determine or define a new screening test is a little bit harder, but the prevention becomes more of an issue in that most women, many women, have had some sort of surgery prior to their diagnosis. And so we're able to catch many people in that position with this opportunistic salpingectomy procedure in that manner.
Dr. Wallace, going back to the genetics for a moment and the fact that early detection or screening is very difficult for ovarian cancers, what do you tell your patients when it comes to potential genetic testing and how that may play into making decisions about how to defend yourself against cancers like these, breast cancer, ovarian cancer for women?
Yeah, great question. So anytime a woman has a family history of ovarian cancer, and certainly a personal history of ovarian cancer, we're doing genetic testing to look for any mutations that might be present that are inherited. There are specific parameters around breast cancer diagnoses and, you know, which family member had what breast cancer, what age, is, as well as other cancers, right? Colon cancers, uterine cancers, pancreatic, certain types like melanoma of skin cancer. So there are many different cancers that can be associated with these genetic mutations that we're looking for. And we have excellent genetic counselors that can go through pedigrees and help people get genetic testing when it's indicated.
What are the side effects of removing the fallopian tubes besides the potential for early surgical onset menopause? Have there been, I'm thinking of pharmaceutical commercials where they run down the side effects and it's a litany and a list. What do you tell your patients when it comes to this?
Yeah, when we're removing the fallopian tubes only,
yeah,
we don't see that the symptoms or the manifestations of menopause. If we're removing the tubes and the ovaries, then we can run into that. And the risks of doing this in a non-opportunistic fashion, meaning up front, we're doing this for risk reduction, for example, because someone has a BRCA mutation, the risks are really inherent to any kind of surgery. So I usually run through my list of things like pain, bleeding, infection, damage to surrounding organs, hernias, blood clots, you know, and the list kind of goes on. As you were saying, you know, we make sure we go through everything that could be a possibility. It's really a short procedure, and it's really well tolerated. And at the time of another surgery, so if we're doing this in an opportunistic fashion,
right,
it becomes even less of an issue, right? We're already there. We're removing the fallopian tubes of someone who's having surgery for another reason. It takes 5 to 10 minutes to do that in general when we're already there. And it really adds minimal risk and time to the surgery, especially when we are considering the benefit that can be borne.
So when women are hearing this story and the science behind it, and they have concerns, what should they do? How should they approach their doctor? What questions should they be asking about their best defense against ovarian cancer?
Well, I think certainly if any patient is coming in and having a surgery upcoming that in the abdomen or pelvis that might afford them the opportunity to have their fallopian tubes out, I think it's worth asking. It's always a different discussion based on every patient history, you know, certainly if there are genetic implications and that becomes a bit of an easier discussion. These days we are expanding, obviously, in any gynecologic procedure, this has historically been done and therefore our insurance agencies are more used to that. the broader population, now with this New York Times article, we're gaining access, but it is something that we work through to make sure that it's covered and that it's understood, the implications, which can be different for women that are before and after menopause, for example.
I apologize for laughing at the idea of making an insurance company get used to something, but I understand that statement entirely. And the New York Times article that you mentioned has the headline, "Most Ovarian Cancer Isn't, and That Fact Can Save Lives," saying that the vast majority of these cases begin in the fallopian tubes, and by removing them, it can reduce the risk by nearly 80%. You saw that article. As a gynecological oncologist, what was your reaction to this story making the mainstream?
Yeah, Doctors Long and Stone have been champions of this in our field for years now. So I immediately texted my colleagues. It was exciting to see this finally making, you know, mainstream media. Ovarian cancer is difficult to diagnose, difficult to treat, difficult to cure, and we just need the attention. So we're happy to have it and happy to have the conversation and hopefully make progress from it.
Difficult to diagnose, difficult to treat, and difficult to cure. That sounds like a difficult job that you have, Dr. Wallace.
Yeah, it is, but you know, it is also very satisfying to help these women that come in. They're the best patients, and I love it.
And you obviously love them. What's the survival rate for ovarian cancer and you know, your chance once not? Oh, I'm sorry. I probably shouldn't ask then.
It depends. There's a lot. There's a lot that goes into the survival rate. There are many different kinds of ovarian cancer. And so some ovarian cancers have better survival rates than others. The most common type of ovarian cancer that we see is a high-grade serous ovarian cancer. That is the most common type that's associated with some of those genetic mutations that we've been talking about as well. And because there's no screening test and because we find it in an advanced stage, you know, the prognosis over a 5-year time frame is lower. We have many new therapies these days that we can use. There's usually some combination of surgical and systemic or, you know, whole body therapies that we use, and we're able to prolong life better than we were, you know, 7 years ago, even 5 years ago, even. But it is the type of cancer that that can come back and that we often have to treat multiple times.
Is that because you find it at an advanced stage and that's where you're most likely to find it? If we could find it in an earlier stage, would that increase the survival rate? And obviously, if we're able to prevent it, that would be the best bet as we currently stand with science.
You got it. Most of the time we're finding this at a stage three. And so that is obviously, you know, a little bit harder to keep at bay than if we were to find it at stage one.
Yeah.
We have gotten better at that, and we can still cure patients even when they come in there. But yes, you're right. It would be much better if we could find it earlier or even prevent it.
Which goes back to why you started calling your colleagues after you saw this New York Times article. So before this made the Times, did you have to explain to your patients, to folks who were had the genetic mutation, or folks who would be susceptible, women who would be susceptible to ovarian cancer? You know, there is this procedure that could go a long way in potentially saving your life.
Always. I almost insist to a certain extent. Obviously, everyone has bodily autonomy, and so we make those decisions together. But this is a procedure that is so quick and can bring so much benefit that I often, you know, discuss it with patients and say we really should do this and explain it thoroughly. You mentioned your family. I had a family member who several years ago had a hysterectomy for a benign indication. We don't have a family history. And I was like, and they're taking your tubes, right? and I said, well, they could. Let's make sure of that. And so, you know, these conversations extend beyond, you know, the patients, but with our family members as well, to make sure we're all aware and thankful. I'm very thankful for this article and helping with this, but all aware of this option.
How long has this option been around, and what's the disconnect as you see it between going from what you know as a gynecological oncologist and what your patients are aware of as options?
Our field has been doing this for the past, you know, 7 to 10 years, I would say at least,
wow.
Taking out the tubes at the time of other surgeries like hysterectomy, for example.
Mm-hmm.
That's an easier sell when you're there for a gynecologic reason for patients and others. When you're there to repair a hernia or take out a gallbladder, it is, you know, not often thought about. And I don't think that there's any malice that has been present. It's just we aren't thinking about those things when we're there to take out someone's gallbladder.
Right.
And so this article is now kind of raising awareness that, hey, if we can't come up with yet, if we can't yet come up with a good screening test, and we're going to be there anyway, why not do this quick procedure that can prevent ovarian cancer while we're still working on the rest?
By nearly 80%.
Yeah.
That number is just staggering, especially when you consider, you know, just the face you made when I asked you about the survival rate, that this is the best path for survival, potentially for women who may be susceptible to ovarian cancer. Dr. Summer Wallace, our guest, we're talking about how did you refer to it again? I am going to struggle saying it.
Opportunistic salpingectomy.
Opportunistic salpingectomy. It's about removing the fallopian tubes, potentially preventing up to 80%, nearly 80% of ovarian cancers. If you have a question for Dr. Wallace, gynecological oncologist at UW Health and an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, we invite you to join us at 1-800-642-1234 or give us an email, talk@WPR.org. Our conversation continues in just a couple minutes. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to WPR News. The procedure is called opportunistic salpingectomy, and it could reduce ovarian cancers by nearly 80%. Our guest to speak on this is Dr. Summer Wallace, a gynecological oncologist at UW Health and an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Let's get right to your calls, questions, and comments now at 1-800-642-1234 or email talk at WPR.org. And we'll start with Annie in La Crosse. Hi, Annie.
Hi. Say, to me, if there was any chance of having cancer after having fallopian tubes taken out, why wouldn't you just have the whole thing taken out the first time? I mean, having menopause early to me seems like a small thing compared to being concerned about having cancer at all. So why just take the fallopian tubes when you can take everything to begin with and take away the risk? That's my question.
Thank you, Annie. Dr. Wallace?
I think that's a fair question, and it's an easier answer in women that I see, for example, who are after menopause.
Mm-hmm.
So we often, when I'm seeing patients, will, you know, take out the tubes and ovaries, both, if that's what a patient desires. When you're there for a different indication that is not gynecologic, it's a little bit of a harder sell, both for the purposes of the procedure and who's going to do it at that time and for our insurance companies. That being said, it is not wrong. And if we get to that point, I think we would all be happy about that in the general scheme of things in patients who have already gone through menopause. Our understanding of the hormone production during this transition and after menopause is developing. And so understanding the optimal age at which we can take the ovaries and not cause impact has kind of changed over time. Certainly before menopause, this is a bigger conversation. I can't disagree with you. I'm living in this like biased world of gynecologic cancers. So I also feel like, just take them all out. but that being said, in women before menopause, that has implications for their body, like we kind of mentioned earlier.
Sure, but there's also a psychological aspect, right? Because I'm of an age where a lot of the women I know have a sense of real dread about the encroachment of menopause, like not looking forward to this one bit. And when you say that this could be a potential side effect of preventing all these cancers, then it comes up against this psychological dread that has been sort of gnawing at women around my age.
Yeah, and then when you take them out, that's it. It's surgical menopause. It's not that transition that is kind of a natural process and can be somewhat slower and more indolent. It's an immediate, menopause. And so those symptoms can be more pronounced in those cases sometimes. And the earlier we do it, the more we can have other health side effects. Even in some studies, changes in mortality or increased mortality. So we have to be really careful about when and who and that discussion. But I can't disagree with you that I think that makes total sense to take them all out. And we're making progress.
Annie, great question. Thank you for the call. We'll go to Sarah in Minocqua next. Sarah, hi. Sarah, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you very much. Thank you, doctor, for taking my call. I've had my ovaries taken out prophylactically post-menopause due to my mother's history of having ovarian and dying of ovarian cancer. My fallopian tubes were not removed. Would I be advised to have that procedure done now? Thank you.
Sarah, how old are you?
I'm 70.
70.
Okay. Well, I can't give personal medical advice. However, I will say, generally speaking, fallopian tube cancer can be a precursor to ovarian cancer, and we generally do remove both the tubes and ovaries in women who are at a higher risk for that reason.
Okay. So what would Sarah want to talk to her gynecologist about here?
I would ask. I would just go in and say, hey, you know, I have this family history, explain it and lay it out and say, when I had my ovaries removed, I think they may have left my fallopian tubes, and start that discussion. Say, I saw this New York Times article, or I heard on WPR, and I wanted to know if you think that I should have my tubes out based on this. It, you know, obviously adds a surgery when we're talking about doing that, but it is a minor procedure in the grand scheme of surgical procedures, depending on everyone's personal history. Like if you've had a lot of surgery or not, things can change about risk. But it's a good conversation to have so that you can understand the risk and benefit of another surgery with tubal removal.
Sarah, thank you for the call. We'll go to Meredith in Greenwood next. Hi, Meredith.
Hi. Hey, my mom passed away from ovarian cancer, but she was 80 when she was diagnosed. And like her mother had breast cancer, but she was 80 when she was diagnosed. She had a mastectomy and she lived 10 more years. Now, my mom wasn't that lucky. But my thought is, when I go to the doctor and they want a medical history, and I say, well, my mom had ovarian cancer and my grandma had breast cancer, I am absolutely not concerned about it because they were like really old when they got it. So I'm just wondering, is my train of thought correct, or should I be more concerned?
Great question. You're right in that, for example, postmenopausal breast cancer carries less risk of having a genetic mutation, and age does play into cancer risk in general, including ovarian cancer. And so those are more mature women who developed these cancers. And I'm really sorry to hear about that and your family and your mom. Generally speaking, about 17 to 20% of ovarian cancers are genetic. So usually your mom these days would have been tested even though she was 80. And so depending on other family history, you may be interested in considering a discussion about genetic testing. It depends on who, you know, may benefit in your family. And so, you know, I don't know that just because of their age, I would omit the consideration, but I definitely understand that thought process.
So next steps would be considering potentially genetic testing. And you also mentioned the rest of the family. If Meredith has kids, would they also be considered for genetic testing?
Right. Yep. So as soon as genetic testing is performed, if a mutation is found, then other family members can be tested and can be screened appropriately from there.
Meredith, thank you for the call. Are there symptoms of ovarian cancer or indications that someone should see a gynecologist for it?
I'm so glad you asked. I was thinking on the break, I would be remiss not to talk about the signs and symptoms of ovarian cancer. They are vague. And that's part of the reason that we catch it at a later stage. So generally speaking, women might notice feeling a new pain or pressure in their abdomen or pelvis. They may feel full early or bloated. There may be changes in how they're having bleeding patterns depending on their age. There may be changes in how people have bowel movements or urination. And so these are all vague yeah. symptoms, right, that you might attribute to something else and often are attributed to something else, like indigestion or heartburn or irritable bowel syndrome, for example.
Or just getting older.
Yeah, or menopause. Sometimes these symptoms are attributed to menopause. And
sure.
So, you know, I always tell people, you know your body better than anyone. And yes, we all have a pain that comes and goes, or constipation that comes and goes, and that's fine. But if something is coming and not going, or becoming nagging, and you're wondering about it, just ask a healthcare provider. It's better to do that. And we can keep things moving along, because eventually what happens is people show up enough, imaging happens, and then we kind of discover this diagnosis.
Dr. Summer Wallace, gynecological oncologist at UW Health, associate professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, talking about the procedure opportunistic salpingectomy, the removal of the fallopian tubes, which could prevent as much as 80%, nearly 80% of ovarian cancer. And if you have questions about this procedure, you are welcome to join us, or questions yourself, 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org. We'll go to Cindy in Mount Horeb next. Hi, Cindy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So I am a 12-year ovarian cancer survivor, and I was fortunate enough to find the mass myself. I was traveling and very gassy, and I was rubbing my belly trying to work some gas through, and I noticed a lump in my abdomen. So when I got home, I went to the doctor. She said it was nothing. I still wasn't satisfied. I went to the emergency room thinking maybe I had like an aneurysm or something, you know? And so they did a CAT scan and they found a softball-sized mass in my abdomen. So I was lucky. They caught it at 1A. And I tell every woman I meet, my husband is so tired of hearing me say this. Once a month when you do your breast self-exam, lay down on your and palpate your abdomen. You might not know what you're feeling, but you'll notice a change. Saved my life.
Cindy, thank you so much for your story and the suggestion. Dr. Wallace, should we be doing abdominal exams?
Thank you for calling and sharing that.
Yeah.
I love to hear it. I'm an emotional lady, and it makes me really happy to hear someone who's had a good story. Yeah, you know, that's an interesting question that is going to be different for everyone. Some people will be able to do that type of evaluation and feel a change. Sometimes it's not big enough to be able to feel a change. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people will have a really big mass and it just over time grows slowly until we kind of say, wait, what's going on here? And you're right. How things went for you is how it usually happens, where you come in and you get evaluated and you come in again and then you finally get some imaging and then get the diagnosis. And so I would say, remaining vigilant, you know, remaining kind of, aware of your body and how things are changing. And as you did so wonderfully, remaining your own biggest advocate. So, you know, if you feel like something is wrong, don't give up, and keep talking. And thank you for spreading the word and telling everyone. I love that.
We'll never get tired of hearing it, Cindy. So yeah. Thank you. We'll go to Wayne in Hayward next. Wayne, hi.
Yes, thank you for taking my call, doctor. My wife had ovarian cancer, and they did what they called a debulking surgery. And after that, she got on chemo. And the oncologist kept doing what they call a CA125 marker, and I'm just wondering what that was. Ultimately, my wife did pass away, but I was curious about that test. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for calling in, Wayne, and for sharing your wife's story so that her life can benefit others. We use a CA125 is a blood test that is used to help monitor ovarian cancer. It is a lab test that we grab. It's a blood test. When someone after menopause is found to have an ovarian or adnexal, the adnexa is the fallopian tube and ovary kind of complex, adnexa. When someone has a mass of those structures, we'll do that blood test. And it is not specific, which means you can have a high CA125 or an abnormal finding and not have cancer, and vice versa. You can have a normal one and still have cancer. So you might be saying, well, why on earth are you doing that test? But in a woman who is after menopause, has a mass, and has an elevated CA125, that is a red flag and raises our suspicion. When it is elevated at the beginning at diagnosis, and as you alluded to, we do our upfront treatment, which is usually some combination of surgery and chemotherapy. We follow that lab test during what we call surveillance in order to monitor. Now, it will fluctuate. If somebody has certain conditions, it might bump up and then go back down. But what we are looking for is a significant rise or change that is maintained over time that might prompt us to do imaging, for example, to try to catch a recurrence as early as possible.
And the debulking surgery that he mentioned?
Yeah, so that is a common procedure done for advanced stage, for example, stage 3 ovarian cancer. And that is a procedure where we make an incision on the belly. We remove, you know, obviously the uterus, cervix, fallopian tubes, and ovaries, as well as anything else that looks like cancer. And that's where the word debulking comes in. So we're really removing everything like lymph nodes, any other soft tissue masses, the omentum, which is a fatty apron that comes off of all of our stomachs, for example. Sometimes we remove the spleen. Sometimes we remove a piece of the bowel and put it back together. But this is done in an effort to remove all the cancer that we can see, or at least the textbook definition would be to get it down to a centimeter or less in any given place. And the purpose of that is for the chemotherapy to work at its best potential.
Wayne, I am very sorry for your loss and very grateful for your call, and hopefully it can do some good. And Dr. Wallace, I very much appreciate the explanations in a way that I can understand them. We'll go to Connie in Madison next. Connie, hi.
Hi there. Thank you so much for taking my call. And Dr. Wallace, I'm so glad that you are speaking on this topic today. I just wanted to call in and kind of represent the younger women's perspective who have been diagnosed with ovarian cancer. I was diagnosed almost 4 years ago to the day with low-grade serous, which is a slower-growing form of ovarian cancer. But my symptoms were really kind of the normal women benign things, like constipation and some bladder pain that I was having. And there's a nonprofit that focuses on low-grade serous that did a worldwide survey of women diagnosed with low-grade that showed an average of 3 years until diagnosis. So we really get passed around quite a bit to different specialties until they can nail down what our issue is. And going into menopause at the age of 36 was quite drastic. Going from having a lot of estrogen to zero really does impact myself and other young survivors. Sexual function, mental health, relationships. So I just really wanted to emphasize that. And I tell every woman I know, scream it from the rooftops, if you do not want kids or are finished having them, to really think about this. So,
Connie, how are you doing today? You.
I'm actually doing pretty good. I feel good today. Thank you.
Thank you so much for calling and sharing your story, Dr. Wallace.
Yeah, thank you so much. It is true. The diagnosis can be prolonged. The treatment is really hard. And then the quality of life afterwards is difficult sometimes as well. It's a life-altering experience. I think we have work to do when it comes to early our young adults and their diagnosis. We've got a lot of, you know, resources. And for example, we have a what we call the WISH clinic here, which is a women's sexual health clinic that is for for cancer survivors or cancer patients. And so, but beyond that, I think you're right. There's health psychology that can help, and it's a lot of fragmented. And so there could probably be some work done in the quality realm for quality of life and surveillance in patients who are young, on the younger end and premenopausal.
Well, and
part of the changes with hormones, sometimes we can give hormones, and in some instances we can't give them back for the risk of recurrence.
So hormone replacement therapy might not be available for folks who have had cancer already.
Not for everyone. Yeah. For many. Yes, and we can help. For some, there are some contraindications to that depending on the type of ovarian cancer, yeah.
We started this conversation, and Connie, thank you so much for calling. We started this conversation with this New York Times story at the end of July that had you so excited you were calling your colleagues, and was the reason, you know, we have this opportunity to spend an hour with you today, Dr. Wallace, about the opportunistic salpingectomy procedure. I'm just going to say it again because I've finally said it right and feel smart about it. But I've also seen in the news stories the increase of cancers among young people. And because screening's so difficult and, you know, in many cases, doctors would misdiagnosis initially and we've heard those stories from our callers already today. Are we seeing increases in ovarian cancer in younger ages?
To a certain extent, but it's not as pronounced, okay. Certainly, as in like colon cancer and in lung cancer. Those are where those numbers are more pronounced than in ovarian cancer.
Earlier, first half of the hour, you talked about this procedure possibly also reducing the chance of breast cancer. Is there a connection there?
Well, so for example, in those patients who have BRCA mutations, and when we're really removing those tubes and ovaries at an earlier age, removing that hormone and removing the ovaries, not just the tubes. The ovaries are the key there
okay.
to helping reduce breast cancer risk for those patients. Yeah.
And is that because of body's hormones?
You got it. Nailed it. Yep.
What about if you're not going to have kids or you don't plan on having kids and more people seem to be leaning in that direction? What would you suggest to them? Because these numbers are so great in the possibility of reducing ovarian cancers, because the survival rates are not so great when it comes to once you're diagnosed with ovarian cancers. How would you, as a woman not having kids, go about considering this?
Yeah, I think for women who are wanting to consider their options and they don't want to have children anymore and they want to reduce their risk of ovarian cancer, then there are a couple of things to think about. Historically, we've done tubal ligations. There are many, let me just say, there are many ways to prevent having children. What we're talking about here is, you know, the surgical options. And so tubal ligation is something that we have done for decades. And we did recognize earlier on that there was an improvement in ovarian cancer risk, even with just the ligation or tying the tubes.
Huh.
And so we've expanded on that with this research and now think that probably just removing the whole tube instead of, you know, making a defect or a ligation of the tube.
Especially since this procedure is, you know, about 30 minutes and most patients are out the same day.
Right. So, for example, if a woman is getting a cesarean and she knows she doesn't want to have any children any longer and we're there doing that procedure, then taking out the tubes is the natural thought there. And it's something that we do offer to patients who have that desire.
And it might be something that patients, I mean, because we've heard it, I've had to go to a doctor and then another doctor. It might be something that patients would need to bring up to their doctor and might have to initiate this discussion.
Yeah, you know, if you're having a discussion about what to do about preventing pregnancy and you're not wanting to have children any longer, and you're going to be having a procedure anyway, then it is something to discuss. Here, our practice is to do a salpingectomy or remove the tubes when we're doing that in order to prevent pregnancy. Other places might still do tubal ligation, and that's okay. It does still reduce the risk, but it is worth a conversation or a question like, hey, what if we just remove the whole tube? Is that an option? And that might be even better.
And insurance companies might be getting used to it. I'm using your term on that.
Right. Thank you. Yeah. when it comes to removing the tubes for the purposes of preventing pregnancy, yes, we're well established with that.
Dr. Summer Wallace, I want to thank you for this hour and sharing your wisdom with us and doing so in a way that I can understand it and in a way that I have no doubt will do some good down the road. So it has just been a pleasure. And when the time comes and we need to, I hope we have this opportunity again. I can't thank you enough.
Thank you so much for having me and spreading the word. And thanks to the callers for sharing their stories. It's been wonderful.
Oh, no kidding about that. The callers that joined us this hour, I want to thank you for sharing as well. I just, I think we did some good this hour. And I don't think that every day about what I do. So I know you do, Dr. Wallace. We'll do it again. So thank you, Dr. Summer Wallace, a gynecological oncologist at UW Health and an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. We spent the hour talking about the procedure of opportunistic salpingectomy, which, as we started with the conversation at the start of the hour, the New York Times ran an article at the end of the July that you can find, which says and finds that procedure could reduce ovarian cancers by nearly 80%. Thank you all. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to WPR News.